Thank you for that. We're really glad to be at the seminar today, and we're especially very excited to see what you're up to on this project, which we've been watching keenly for quite a while, and especially this seminar series you've got on negotiating networks, as it really sort of marks this upturn in interest in quantitative measures in literary history. Interesting, when we first decided to work on this topic, we had no idea we'd be part of this zeitgeist. Rather, Sebastian was a network scientist, I had some letters I wanted to analyse, we were married, seemed like the obvious thing to do. So as it turned out, we came up with some very interesting observations on the body we first looked at, and it's kind of bred a conviction that more literary historians need to be using these tools when approaching the archives, whether that is a digital archive or an analogue one.
And today we'll be presenting our findings on the forthcoming publication that analyses an analogue archive. So that means we've actually spent a lot of time looking at the manuscripts in the Manual College Library and in the British Library. And we will also be talking you through the later the early stages of a much larger body of letters, which comes from the State Papers Online. And these are more preliminary results, but they will give you a glimpse of what we're planning to do in the near future. Together we hope they make a persuasive case for quantitative network analysis of historical data.
So our first foray into network analysis involved a collection of letters I'm very familiar with from my work on prison literature and that I'm currently editing with Tom Freeman. So these are a body of 289 letters found in John Fox's publications and his manuscript archive, which is the manuscripts held at the British Library and Emmanuel College Library. So these are letters written by Protestants during Mary I's reign. Most of them were written by prisoners, and they show how former leaders from the Edwardian reign were continuing to lead the Reformation from their prison cells by sending out letters giving pastoral guidance and doctrinal instruction to their co-religionists spread across the country and in the continent.
We wanted to see what these letters can tell us about the Protestant community's social organisation. If you can plot this body of letters as a network by sort of stripping out most of the data and turning them into what you might know as metadata. There's, of course, an interesting connection with the recent NSA scandal which was all about the metadata of phone calls, which is the data of who sends and receives a call. So it's a bit like that in that we strip the letters down to who sent the letters to whom, when were they sent, from where were they sent, and quite importantly also we recorded the commendations in these letters. So this data was collected by Ruth by looking at the actual text of the letters, and it's crucial because it allows us to get a sense of the local communities that surrounded the people who sent and received these letters. So the people are the nodes in the network, and the relationships are the edges. And the letters provide us with a variety of relational links. So there's first the simple link from the sender to the recipient, but then there's a number of other links that come from these commendations or from mentioned connections between individuals in these letters. And this results in a total network of 377 nodes and 795 edges. So it's quite a large network. And we were able to generate a visualization of this network of the Protestant community. And you may have seen other sort of network visualizations in digital humanities projects. And quite often people try to map these onto an actual geographical map. Here we just are concerned with sort of drawing the network in the most in the clearest way, and that means that we use an algorithm to lay out the network so that the sort of most important nodes, the best connected nodes are at the center, and the peripheral nodes are nodes with few connections. This is called a force-directed layout, meaning you're sort of treating the edges as springs and trying to minimize the overall energy.
Because of this, we can actually begin to see visually who is important in the network. So if we zoom in, for example, on this note, this is John Bradford. He's right at the centre of things, and he's one of the martyrs who appears really prominently in Fox's Book of Martyrs and wrote lots of letters. So we expect him to be right at the centre. Now, I call him a hub. So hubs are nodes with an anomalously large number of edges. And you'll notice that other nodes in this slide maybe only have one or two links or edges. And this is known as something called a power law distribution. And this is a graph showing the number of people, so the different number of nodes, plotted against the number of edges that they have. And you'll notice that at the right-hand side, there's a very long tail. And to the left, there are many nodes with few edges. And the reason is this is that hubs are rare in a network. And so that's something called the 80-20 rule, that, you know, 20% of people have 80% of the links in a network.
We should perhaps add that degree is the number of connections.
So, yeah, sorry.
So, So we have a lot of nodes that's just one or two connections.
Precisely. And so this shows why hubs have such an important influence over the network's topology. So in a social network, for example, you might think about hubs as the kind of people who create trends or make important deals or spread fads. And we see that all those links coming off hubs create short paths across the network. So any two nodes in the system will be created, will be linked by these kinds of hubs. Hubs make the world of a network very small, despite the fact that this particular network has a geographical reach from Zurich to Manchester.
And the measurement of paths through the network is a crucial way of establishing the importance of people in the network, because and it allows a more rigorous way of measuring importance than just looking at the number of connections. And this is how we're hoping that this quantitative analysis can add to simple visualization, because it highlights rather non-intuitively who is important in the network. And so one possible measure of this connectedness is something called betweenness, which is so that's the formal definition is if you consider pairs of nodes in the network, and you between each of these pairs, there's a shortest path across the network. And now you can count how often such a shortest path flows through a given node or edge. So that means if you imagine two disjoint communities that are connected only by a single individual, then that individual will have a very high betweenness, because a lot of the shortest paths through the network have to flow through that. And it's sort of a non-local measure in the sense that it depends on the overall connectivity, not just on the immediate neighborhood of the node. So we can have a node that has a very high betweenness, but very few connections. It's in a crucial position. And we can calculate this betweenness both for the letter network, so just the network of correspondence by itself, and for the entire social network, which is implied by the commendations and the other links. So if we look at the social betweenness, and then look at the top 20. Most of them are sort of names a historian of that period would expect. Most of them are martyrs. The ones that are shown here that you can see are martyrs. And most of them also come up for letter betweenness. So there are not too many surprises at this stage.
So another person who comes up this stage is Henry Hart. And historians of this period will also expect him to appear, because he was a separatist figure. He was a leader of a group called the Free Willers, and there was a big controversy in the Protestant community between people who believed in free will and predestination, and this created quite a lot of correspondence, and this explains why he pops up. He produces a lot of correspondence around himself. So, okay, we have martyrs in white, they're important, separatists are important. This is stuff we could probably just guess from having read the letters and knowing a bit about the history. And this is actually quite important, because it tells us that the method works. It tells us that we can put some trust in it when it actually brings up some things that we might not expect. And you'll see that there's some gaps here, because actually this method does bring up a few surprises. And these surprises are people like Calthorpe, Boyer and Anne Smith. And what's surprising about them is none of them wrote any letters in this letter collection. And the reason they do appear is because the people that wrote to them have a very anomalous style of writing, using an excessive number of commendations. And an example is this letter from Bartlett Green to Calthorpe. I love this letter. So he says, "Master Fleetwood, I beseech you, remember Whitrance and Cook, two singular men amongst you common prisoners. Master Fernham and Master Bell, with Master Hussey, as I hope, will dispatch Palmer and Richardson with his companions. I pray you, Master Calthorpe, think on John Grove." And it goes on. And he sends out all of these instructions, basically telling his contacts in the community, and quite a lot of them in a temple, to do things on his behalf, to intercede for prisoners. And these are his tentacles stretching out into the community, and they're doing his work outside the prison.
The other two figures who are slightly surprising to the uninitiated eye are Augustine Berner at number 14 and James Bradshaw. Why does that change?
One's letter between us and one's social between us.
Statistically, Bradshaw looks insignificant. Bradshaw wrote only one letter and received only one, and Augustine Berner wrote two letters and received 12 from four separate people. But there's something more significant about these men that accounts for their betweenness. because they were used as couriers by the martyrs and their co-religionists. Bernard's a particularly significant figure.
Yeah, so this Swiss reformer who settled in England, he's mentioned in quite a lot of letters as a trusted courier to and from the London jails. So he was used particularly by martyrs such as Bradford, Latimer, Ridley, and Careless. And what he did was he smuggled writing materials into them, and he smuggled their letters out, and sometimes to the continent where they were printed. And he also recorded accounts of Latimer and Ridley's disputations and examinations. And Ridley said this lovely thing about him. He said, "Brother Austin, you for our comfort do run up and down, and who bears your costs, I know not." And that image of Bernher running up and down the country and to the continent is exactly why he figures highly as in this measure of betweenness.
And another similar but crucially different measure of importance in the network that also shows Bernard to be very important is called eigenvector centrality. And it's actually similar to the approach that Google uses to rank paid web pages. And it's one of the reasons behind its enormous success is that it actually uses this network algorithm to assess web pages' importance. But it is slightly different from between us in that it measures how well connected you are in a sort of in an elegant recursive way. So you could imagine a node with high eigenvector centrality might be connected, might have a few connections, but all those connections are to hubs, essentially. But it could at the same time, that doesn't mean it has to have, it could have low betweenness centrality, but high eigenvector centrality. So it's a different kind of measurement. It's not so much about the flow across the network, it's more about how well placed you are, how well connected your neighbors are. So if we look at the top 20 for eigenvector centrality, we again get quite a lot of martyrs, unsurprisingly. But we also see several other people we didn't see before. They're all in yellow. So who are these figures? Punt, like Bernard, is a known letter carrier who made several trips to the continent delivering John Hooper's letters to his wife.
But most of the remaining figures, including Margie Cook, who popped up in between this, all appear in John Stripe's list of sustainers, or have been identified as sustainers since that time by Tom Freeman. And sustainers is a kind of term applied to a bunch of people who provided money and goods and food to prisoners and had it smuggled in. And they said they were financially emotionally supporting the prisoners. And importantly, the relationships with the female sustainers especially occasioned the writing of several very important treatises in the period, which brings us to another point that six of the top 20 for letter eigenvector centrality are women. And this is quite an interesting statistic, given this is the 16th century and women are kind of excluded from religious leadership. Now, these women don't necessarily look that important by other measures, by other network measures. Only 49 people in this network, for example, have a non-zero letter between us. So it means that only 49 people in this network have shortest paths going through them. And this means the majority don't. And that includes some of these women. So Marjorie Cook, Lucy Harrington, Elizabeth Fain, and Anne Walkup, they all rank bottom. They have zero letter between us. Yet, this eigenvector centrality tells us that they were still well-connected people. And the question is, why is that? Well, for one thing, it's because their acts of charity put them in direct contact with the martyr hubs. But this isn't the only reason they were well connected.
We can see that they don't only that these women don't only gain their importance through association with the martyrs. It's also their social position in the community that's important. And this is sort of a
this is Marjorie Cook, yeah.
Well, just also this is a snapshot from the kind of interface we use. So the point is, you can't actually see it on the left, but she sends one letter. And she receives altogether seven letters from two people. But if you look at the right side, that's the list of her social links. So she has an enormous number of links with the community, which we know through all these commendations and additional information. And these 26 people she has contact with include infrastructural figures such as Punt and Porridge, heretical leaders like Hart, known sustainers like Elizabeth Fain, and leaders of the London congregation like Robert Coe, who... And all of these people are spread across the south of England, so they're quite widely spread. Now, what the measure of betweenness and eigenvector centrality both bring to the fore are infrastructural figures. showing especially the importance of those nodes whose role is actually minimal in Fox's Book of Martyrs, or they've been edited out altogether in many cases. And this sort of patterning shows the power of algorithms to predict the roles of different nodes in the network. So what we try to do is to try to see whether these quantitative measures can somehow, in some ways, start to predict the roles that people might play in the network. And what we came up with, we placed thresholds on 5 different network measures and then labeled them high or low by using a threshold in order to then classify people in terms of whether they were leaders or network sustainers or peripheral figures.
That's in the next slide. Yeah. Yeah.
So we came up with these 7 categories. And what that's meant to do is not sort of to obviously replace closer analysis, but it's meant to kind of suggest to you what roles the people might have played, and then for you to, for historians to then, through more traditional scholarship, to establish whether these people actually match these roles or not.
That's right. So this grouping of nodes allowed us to identify some general rules about how the network functioned and how information spread across it. And so crucially, we see the most prolific category of leaders frequently and repeatedly wrote to network sustainers. So in the case of John Bradford, who sent the most letters of all the martyrs, we can see that out of the 64 separate people he wrote to, those he wrote to most often were Joyce Hale, 7 letters, Anne Walkup, 6, Lady Elizabeth Vane, 5, Robert Cole, 4, Joan Wilkinson, 4, and this is true of most of the hubs. And this tells us that the quickest paths across the network were also the ones most frequently used, and so most frequently traversed by letters and by carriers as well. Now, in some ways, this ability to extract generalizations and to make predictions about the role of particular people in the network was the most exciting aspect of this of these findings for us. And it seemed to hold much promise, particularly for much bigger archives. And we're thinking especially of digital archives. These conclusions, it would be possible for experts in this field who'd read all the letters to come to some of these conclusions, but it would have been almost impossible for them to measure it and quantify it in the ways that we have. And when you take these kinds of questions to much bigger archives, where I'm thinking of digital archives where you have massive volumes of literature, it's virtually impossible to do anything like this. And so we are going to argue that network science allows scholars to understand the underlying patterns within huge bodies of literature. And this is what we're hoping to do with our new project that Lizzie alluded to, as we move from an analogue archive of 289 letters to the State Papers Online, which has approximately 290,000 pages of manuscripts and over 326,000 catalogue or calendar entries for the Tudor period alone. So in reconstructing and analysing the network implicated in the letters in this archive, we hope to gain an understanding of the changing structures of politics and political power in the Tudor period. And as you'll know, these were dramatic and frequent.
And during the initial stage of this new research project, we've been focusing on a subset of the data, which is the domestic correspondence between 1547 and 1580. And Ruth went through these calendar entries recording the following information for each letter. And so what we've got here is the reign, the calendar number entry, calendar entry number and page, the reference for the original document, the letter date, the place of writing, just as for the other data set, the sender and the recipient, the language, which I think is almost always English, and the document reference. So from this I produced a list of nodes, which Ruth then disambiguated, and this is a step because we wanted to eradicate duplicates created by variant spellings, changes in title, or separate out entries such as Archbishop of Canterbury or Lord Chandos, titles which were held by a number of different people. And it's important to stress this because I think this kind of detailed disambiguation is very important and maybe all too often gets swept under the carpet when people look at large data sets and apply analytic approaches. It's very important to sort of clean up your data and understand the quirks of your data very well in order so that the extracted data is as full and unambiguous and accurate as possible. What's important to note here is that the difference between this material and the data set we talked about before, in the work on Protestants, we put a lot of emphasis on commendations, which are short-range links and emphasize local communities. But because we're working with such a huge amount of data now, we can't read every letter and extract recommendations anymore. But what we can, what this new approach allows us to do is to take such a large data set and to highlight maybe sub-collections of letters where it's worth going back and reading the letters in full and extracting additional information. So to summarize, what this can do is it can guide us towards more interesting parts, in a sense, of the corpus and highlight unusual patterns in the data.
So what this difference in data collection does mean, however, is that we need to be alert to biases and idiosyncrasies in the record keeping. So crucially, since the state papers are the working papers of the King or Queen's principal secretary, those holding that office are going to probably appear as hubs. But the extent of their connections, of course, will depend on their administrative style and success. So we're expecting Sir William Cecil to prove to be the largest hub because he kept this massive archive and he even sort of developed his own filing and indexing system. I love that. Similarly, our impression of Henrician politics is going to be affected by the fact that Thomas More destroyed a lot of documents before his arrest. So these are going to create anomalies. So the research then is not only an account, it's not only a bird's eye view of Tudor politics, it's also going to give us a history of the creation of this archive, both in its initial compilation and in its subsequent curation and digitization. So what does our initial sample show us? So from our fast swathe of data, we're already beginning to see some trends and some surprising results that are sending us back to the original documents.
And we started by first reconstructing and measuring separately the domestic correspondence network for the reigns of Edward and Mary, and then Elizabeth up to 1580. So we're dealing with three separate networks. And starting with Edward, his reign shows much what we would expect. It's a fairly small network. And Edward VI is both, he is and he isn't at the centre of this network. And you'll see what I mean if you look at his statistics, which, the first number is the value of that statistic, and the second number is the rank Edward VI occupies. So that means he has the highest out degree, meaning he communicates with 11 people in the network, and 11 different people, and that places him top of this rather small network. But you can see that on most other counts he is not really ranking very highly. And he's outranked by three people, in particular, and that is Edward Seymour, Thomas Seymour Moore, and John Dudley. And the reason for their influence is fairly obvious if you look at the historical background, because Edward Seymour became Lord Protector at the beginning of Edward's reign. He was ultimately ruling on Edward's behalf. His brother Thomas Seymour was made Lord High Admiral, but plotted against his brother, married Henry VIII's widow Catherine, and then, after her death, made a bid to win the hand of Princess Elizabeth. He was arrested and imprisoned in 1549 and later executed. So he was also very much at the centre of this network. And Dudley became Great Lord, Lord Great Chamberlain at the beginning of Edward's reign, working closely with Protector Somerset. But then planned Somerset's overthrow and then became Lord President of the Privy Council. And he tried to ensure his continued influence on Edward's death through the by putting Lady Jane Grey on the throne. So these three people are highly connected in the network. And you can see that they rank very highly on a lot of network measures, especially if you look at the bottom two statistics, which are the betweenness and the eigenvector centrality. But there's one person which who stops even these three figures from getting to the top spot in all of the rankings, and that is William Cecil, later Lord Burghley, who comes sort of top on almost every count in Edward's reign. And he's rising to prominence in the Edwardian period, but he does not have the influential government positions he would go on to occupy under Elizabeth. And he certainly doesn't have the clout of the of Protector Somerset, but he did have the benefit of proximity to some of the most influential figures.
Yeah, so in 1547, he entered Protector Somerset's service, and then by the following year he'd become his secretary. And that advancement proved to be unlucky at first, because he ended up in prison for 2 months after Somerset's fall. But by the following September, he'd already kind of regained his position. He was a Privy Councillor and Third Secretary of State. And I'm quite interested in this particular quote in the ODMB, because it kind of explains exactly how well connected he was. It says, "In the temporary alliance between the former Protector and John Dudley, Earl of Warwick, Cecil acted as intermediary, enjoying the confidence of both." So Somerset's second fall, Cecil managed to kind of ride out the storm, and he was actually created a knight following Dudley's creation as Duke of Northumberland. So what's important is Cecil very successfully bridged the two kind of leadership periods within Edward's reign. And that statement about enjoying the confidence of both shows how he was cultivating his contacts in this period. It also suggests a kind of directed network, that the kind of information was coming towards him, but that he wasn't sending much out. And this is borne out by the stats, actually, because he only sends one letter in this period, but he has a very, very high out strength of 51, which means he sent out 50 in strength of 234, which means he received 234 separate letters. And if we think about who's number two after him, it's actually Edward Seymour, and he only has 35. So 35, 234. This is a real anomaly. And one of the reasons for that is he really took advantage of the career opportunities presented by his post as secretary. He cultivated contacts widely across Protestant humanists at home and serving abroad as diplomats. But I'm interested in this discrepancy between his in and out degree. So what this means is that while he ranks very highly for in degree, so what things he receives, and in strength, which affects his ranking for total degree and total strength, he then ranks very low for betweenness and eigenvector centrality, which, as we've shown, is a measure of how well connected you are. And that's quite important.
Well, we can now ask who were the other well-connected people in this reign. And of the three reigns we studied, Edward's was actually the least surprising in some sense. Only 21 people have a non-zero betweenness measure, and most of those are people involved high up in government, or in the case of Ridley and Turner, it can be described as the religious arm of the government. But what is maybe more interesting is that among the sea of male governing figures, we see the two women who were gone to be rival claimants to the throne after Edward's death.
So this, of course, sent me back to the original letters to see what's going on there. So both women are unsurprisingly in contact with key governing figures and their wives. So the letters to and from Lady Jane Grey actually reveal very little about her future political status. There's a letter of thanks to Thomas Seymour and a book sent to her by Mildred Cecil. But Mary's are a bit more interesting, and each of them shows her to be a kind of a figure of tension within the network. And this is because she was at the time, of course, as you know, resisting religious policy and trying not only to maintain her status during her brother's reign, but also to cultivate her own followers. So two of the earliest letters from 1547 show her with letters of appeal to Protector Somerset and the Duchess of Somerset, asking them to show their favour to her former servants, whose position was left in quite in some uncertainty. And we see, therefore, that she's in this kind of precarious position, trying to make sure that actually these people are put into future servants, and she's reliant on the goodwill of the government. Yet she also has a certain sway that you can tell that they're kind of slightly scared of her status. And this is shown especially in this particular letter, which is one that Edward wrote to Mary in 1549 about her refusal of the new Order of Common Prayer. And this is part of a wider pattern of behaviour that we see from Mary in this period. From reports in other letters about Mary, we hear that she was very publicly expressing her own Catholic faith and holding masses in her house in direct resistance of some compromises offered to her by the government, by the council. And it was therefore feared that she was going to become a kind of figurehead for Catholic resistance.
And Mary's prominence in these betweenness and eigenvector rankings raises some questions about how we think about political tension and resistance and changes in the network. And Well, we would like to do, it's one of our aims is to create a temporal visualization of the changing network over time. But we can also apply more rigorous quantitative measures of temporal network analysis, which are actually a very active topic at the moment in network science, that are beginning to emerge because of the abundance of temporal network data in social online networks and other things like that. So this is a problem that people are generally very interested in, and it would be nice to apply that to this data. But even with the material methods we've already got here, we can see the important changes that happen between reigns. So if we look at the top ranking figures for betweenness, we looked at which of them retained an influential position in the move from Edward's Protestant reigns to Mary's Catholic one. And many of them had died during Edward's reign. Others were imprisoned and later executed in Mary's. These figures are all absent from the network in Mary's reign. Of those remaining, we see that some are politically resilient. Others, on the other hand, fail to weather the political change. And these are then prompt points for going back to the letter collections and understanding why this happened. But the broad trend is that most of them disappear or decrease in importance, mainly due to religious or political affiliations. For example, Cecil declined office from the Marian government, choosing to retire from office on his own volition for religious reasons, but he remained on good terms with the new regime. Others lose importance for less obvious reasons, such as Herbert, Russell, and Woodhouse. Despite remaining in favour, they drop down the rankings. This is maybe because they also shift their emphasis or their sphere of influence away from that recorded by the current sample of letters. Now, Peter, Sir William Peter, is one figure to buck the trend. He was among the councillors in London who changed sides after initially supporting Lady Jane Grey. And he was then reappointed secretary, and this placed him at the centre of political negotiations in the following years. If we widen our search criteria to other measures, we can also see that Poole and Rich attain some significance. If we compare Poole's degree, he moves up several places. Poole's degree in the Marian and the Edwardian reign, he moves up several places. And also Rich's eigenvector centrality also moves him higher. And he's one of the very few people who actually maintain a high level of influence between reigns. And he's someone we want to look at more in the coming months for that reason. So who are the other high-ranking people in Mary's reign?
So again, looking at betweenness gives a really good measure of the sort of movers and shakers in Mary's reign. And we get a similar outcome to Edward's reign in that the vast majority of people are in local or central government, so that's fine. They're all in white. But again, we're interested in anomalies here. And the anomalies, interestingly, turn out to be anomalous for the same reasons, in that all the people in yellow were suspected of rebellion in Mary's reign for at different levels. And the most interesting case that I want to talk about briefly before we conclude is Edward Courtenay. And for those of you who don't know his history, I'll just give you a brief overview. So when Mary came to the throne, he'd already been in prison for 15 years since the age of 12. He was imprisoned as a child with his parents because of their allegiance to Catherine of Aragon, and because it was suspected that they wanted to marry their son to Princess Mary. And shortly following his release, Courtenay was made Earl of Devon. He was made a Knight of the Bath, and he was thought to be kind of leading candidate to be Mary's husband for those people who wanted her to marry within the realm. Unbeknown to them, she had already kind of set her sights on a Habsburg match. And on the 29th of October 1553, she secretly pledged herself to Philip II. Now, Mary's determination to marry out of the realm sent many men into kind of conspiracy. So Sir James Croft, Sir Peter Carew, Sir Thomas Wyatt, and the Duke of Suffolk, they all plotted to have kind of simultaneous risings against the regime. So in the West Country, in Herefordshire, in the Midlands, and in Kent. And the rebels, they probably were anticipating the deposition of Mary and the replacement of her with Elizabeth, possibly married to Courtenay. So Courtenay's involvement in this situation, in these risings, is unknown. But he was suspected so much that he was then put in prison again for another year and a bit. Poor guy, following which he was then very quickly dispatched to the imperial court at Brussels, essentially just to keep him out of the way. It was another form of imprisonment in some ways. He was later given permission to travel to Italy, probably because he'd actually requested that because he felt that he was at danger in the imperial court. Italy, in fact, was no safer because there was actually a plot against him to have him executed, to have him assassinated, although it was never carried out and he seems to have died of natural causes. Now, Courtenay's seeming centrality in this network piques my interest because it seemed very odd that someone suspected of rebellion and plotting against the crown should be at its centre, should be so well connected and ranked so highly in terms of betweenness and eigenvector centrality. And I'm currently undertaking a detailed study of all the letters sent to him, from him, and mentioning him. And I'm starting to find some trends. So far, two important things have emerged. Firstly, is that although most of the letters sent to him are holographs, so original letters, those he sent are nearly all, at least over 85% of them, are intercept copies. So what that means is copies made by English and or imperial postmasters or spies. And so what this tells us is that although Courtenay was essentially disenfranchised, he'd been imprisoned, exiled, was plotted against, and as his letters show, he was seeking financial aid in a lot of cases. So he was feeling that he wasn't financially supported. He was perceived to be very important by the Marian government, to the extent that they needed to carefully monitor his correspondence. The second thing that these letters show is the kinds of contacts that he had. He was in contact with Sir Philip Hoby, who was a key figure conspiring against Mary in a conspiracy organised by Henry Dudley. The letter Courtenay actually wrote to Hoby is very strange. It's asking about Peter Carew's religion, and Carew is another plotter. So he's mixing in very suspicious circles. He has also mentioned two trips to the Duke of Ferrara, who he didn't need to visit a second time. And we know from other sources that the Duke was trying to persuade him to join the group around Dudley, who was plotting against Mary. So this is all very suspicious.
And what we can see from this particular case study is that the method allows us to find interesting patterns in the state papers archives. And it doesn't just tell us about the structures of government, but it alerts us to the people the government were interested in. And in some sense, the most untrustworthy figures require the most careful documentation. So this gives rise to interesting biases in the letter collection, which itself of historical interest and are worth studying further. To conclude then, we hope that you see, even with this first swathe of information, we are beginning to see some important trends emerging, and that we are being directed to look at specific collections of letters. We're interested both in the broad trends, for instance, that most of the high-ranking figures are government figures, which are perhaps less surprising, but also the anomalies. And next we will be adding in Henry's reign, the foreign correspondence of Mary's and Edward's reign, and we will be completing our data for Elizabeth's reign, and also adding in the foreign papers for that too. We haven't got time to speak about our findings on the Elizabethan data today, but we don't want to draw too many conclusions before we actually have the full data for that reign. But it's important to note that there are many more letters for Elizabeth's reign. So we already have, even though we don't have the complete data set yet, we already have 1,285 members in this network. And what's that?
Oh, that was Devonshire's letter. Okay. Yeah.
So that's just a quick slide on Elizabeth's reign. And it means that we're already circling some letter collections for further analysis, even thanks to these preliminary findings. As well as highlighting the importance of governmental and leading church figures who have been sort of overlooked a bit in scholarship, such as Richard Cox, for instance, several non-governmental figures pop up, and we would like to see why they are so well connected. These are, for instance, Daniel Hechstetter, who was a German mine manager and had strong links with Furland. We've got William Hurl, who was a spy in Intelligentsia, whose shady activities have been brought to light by the editorial and scholarly work of Robin Adams. And finally, an alchemist, Cornelius Alnito, who was imprisoned for his failure to manufacture gold for the Queen. And we also want to find out who John Johnson is, who not much scholarship.
There's nothing on him.
There's not much scholarship on him. But We hope report more on these fascinating characters in the near future.
Yeah, so we're going to leave you there, not with a conclusion, but with a tantalising hint of what's to come. So thank you for listening, and we'd be happy to answer any questions or comments you might have.